I need water.
Good morning.
This is
what happened, Brian.
I was packing.
You're struggling.
But I leave in at 10 for 5. Open the House Committee on Interim Committee on Rural Communities. And let me open an organizational meeting. First, before we take a motion, let me just introduce our new member, Rep. Kathy McEwen. I think maybe you can talk about your connection to rural Oregon quite easily in this particular case.
I will do my very best. Thank you. Would you like a little introduction?
Yeah, please.
Oh, I'm Representative McEwen. I represent House District 9, which is Coos Beatty, Yahats, and into the western edge of Elmira. And born and raised on the coast, lived there all my life. Actually spent some. I actually studied agriculture at Oregon State. I was an ag major there. Didn't ever put anything into practice, but spent time studying those wonderful things that can happen when you grow stuff. And born and raised fishing and hunting and doing things that are very basic in rural communities. Very happy to be on this committee. When we found that there was a conflict between the new schedule for the interim and my ag committee and my transportation committee were meeting at the same time, it became problematic. So the speaker called and graciously offered me an opportunity to jump onto this committee, and I'm very happy to be here. I know you all deal with things that are pertinent in my part of the world, which is the South Coast, and delighted to be able to participate.
Well, I might just take the opportunity to comment a little bit on the new name for those of you that are curious. So back in, I think it was the interim of 08, when now Senator Roblin was chairing the House Agriculture Committee, there was a section on there at the very end that was called Rural Communities, or something, Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. And I think we can largely attribute all these rural community committees to Arnie. They met and did a variety of interim hearings around the state. They came back with rural telecom and a whole bunch of other stuff. So then when he became a senator, I think they established a new committee that handled a lot of agricultural type issues, but then also random other issues like broadband or telco, rural telco. And we obviously still just had the one committee. And I think the speaker, I complained a little bit about only having a limited number of bills compared to the workload of the other committees. And so I think the effort was to rebalance a little bit and align more with the Senate committee so there's a more predictable path for where bills coming out of will go. And so I think that's largely the theory, though it's not as, it gives the speaker options, I notice, and it gives the Senate president options between the other environmental committees. But I think it's a fairly predictable situation. If something comes out of here, it goes to Arnie and vice versa, or Senator Roblin, and vice versa. And it was at my request. I wanted to have a little broader scope and a few more bills than last time. So that's the story.
Is that why? I thought our bill was heavy last time.
Is no more urban issues like annexation.
It still would have land use stuff, just like Senator Roblin's committee would. No, I still got a few bills that didn't quite make it. I don't know about February. Where's Aaron? What do you think, February? Okay, let's get going. Madam Vice Chair. Wow, that's a quick promotion you got right here.
Vice Chair to Vice Chair. We just did a straight swap, Lou and I did. Representative Frederick.
That's right. I would take a motion on our rules, if you've got one there.
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 17th, 2013.
Representative McEwen moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 17, 2013. Any discussion? Any objection? Okay, if not, the rules are adopted. And let me open our informational meeting. And let's start with, let's talk about LIDs and sideboards for them. So Dave and Aaron, do you want to come up together?
Sure.
Representative McEwen, we had a hearing about a specific circumstance where an LID has, in many of our views, I think, gone terribly awry, which, you know, we can talk about if we need to. I mean, what we're now looking at is how to, I don't doubt there's a way to do much retroactively for that situation. We're trying to figure out how to not have stuff like that happen again if there's, you know, a particular jurisdiction that can find some openings. You know, we want to just have parameters around the state. I think this particular situation is probably not something that would be affected by the legislation, so I don't know how much detail you need on that one, but the bottom line is just to take a look at this statute and see if there's a way to have some parameters around it, you know, to make sure people are actually going to get the benefits of it if they're going to be brought into an LID, that kind of thing.
Thank you.
Does that seem basically right?
What?
Mr. Chair,
we may even go backwards. I don't know. You tell us, Dave.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. When last we left this issue, we actually dealt with this twice, or this committee
With
this twice last session. Once with fees in lieu of local improvement districts, the city of the Dalles, as you may recall, was charging a fee in lieu of a local improvement district, rather than actually forming the district and assessing the property owners according to their share of the total project cost. The Dalles was simply charging a fee, which they deposited in their general fund, and on the assumption that at some point, maybe someday, they would actually go out and make the improvements. And the amount of the fee, as you recall, ranged from a low of $50,000 to a high of about $180,000. And then we had, towards the end of the session, we had the chair had a hearing, and I think we had, if I recall, we had an informational hearing on a problem arising out of Kaiser with the Rollins family, with a local improvement district assessment of $6 million on a piece of property with a real market value of $300,000. With a family in Representative Huffman's district that owned property in Kaiser, it was their husband and wife and a mother and father. It was the sole family investment, and of course, with the $6 million assessment, the family is a family of modest means, had absolutely no ability to repay that assessment. That case is now in foreclosure. The city has filed a foreclosure claim against the Rollins family to take the property, and I'm here to report that the lawyer. I'm not here on behalf of the Rollins family, and I don't represent the Rollins family, and I think that's important to put on the record, because the lawyer from the city of Kaiser that was hired, the Portland lawyer that they hired, that the city of Kaiser hired, has threatened to come after the Rollins family personally because of Linda Rollins' testimony in front of the legislature. So we're now looking at first potential personal liability on the Rollins' behalf if they come down and spend their time here at the legislature. So I am here on behalf of Oregonians in Action. I'm not representing the Rollins family. To deal specifically with this issue, I think we had a pretty good discussion in the informational hearing we had towards the end of the session. This is an issue where there's certainly policy positions going both ways, and I understand those and appreciate those. Cities need the ability to be able to raise money to do the infrastructure, to do needed infrastructure improvements, and LIDs, local improvement districts, are one of the tools that cities use to raise the money to make the infrastructure improvements, and we understand that and appreciate that and don't want to get in the way of that. At the same time, there needs to be some kind I appreciate what the chair, how you framed this hearing. There needs to be some kind of sideboards put on that. The statutes currently for local improvement districts are very open-ended. The legislature has left it primarily to the cities to determine how to procedurally conduct an LID, the formation of an LID, the spread of the assessments, the determination of the total project cost. That really is a matter left to local control, and I appreciate that very much as well. But I think we've seen in the last, especially the last session, that there needs to be some legislatively imposed limits on that. One of the options that that we were considering that we might we would ask the chair to entertain would be some type of limit on the percent or on the total assessment assessed to a particular property, and you would tie it into as a percentage of the real market value of the property. So we wouldn't have, as we had in Kaiser, an assessment that's 20 times the real market value of the property. That's just a guaranteed foreclosure, because the property owner with a property valued at $300,000 and a $6 million assessment, even if they bankrupt the assessment and spread the payments, turn it in essentially into a mortgage, another mortgage, isn't going to be able to, in most cases, to pay an assessment that's 20 times the real market value of the property. And that's obviously what's happened with Kaiser. So one of the suggestions that we would have is that you would tie the amount of the assessment into a percentage of the real market value of the property, so that no property owner would be faced with the idea that they were going to have an assessment that exceeds, in some cases multiple times, the value of their land. That's one idea. At this point, it's not fleshed out, obviously, and I talked to Ms. Doyle yesterday. This is one that I think we need to work on with the League, with the League members. This obviously affects the cities predominantly. And so I suggested to Ms. Doyle yesterday, and with the chair's blessing, would hope to form some kind of I hesitate to call it a work group, but to form some kind of group with Ms. Doyle, with any lobbyists from any of the other cities. This is a rural city issue and an urban city. You know, a big city, little city. It affects both. And see if we can come up with something for introduction in February that solves this problem. And maybe, and I would hold out hope that we can also get in and maybe fix the Kaiser problem as well. The litigation is still pending on that, although the city of Kaiser is rushing as quickly as they can to get it done, knowing that the tenor of the last informational hearing didn't go so well for them.
Hmm. Maybe that special session will be useful after all. Okay. Aaron, do you want to?
Just say a thing. Yeah. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. Just as a refresher for folks, local improvement districts are a financing tool that we use to build infrastructure to property that does not currently have the infrastructure. Generally, it's streets, sidewalks, wastewater, and sewer/water access to the property, maybe sometimes expanding capacity. It generally occurs in two situations: one, where the land is completely undeveloped and is becoming developed, or two, where we're upgrading land that was urbanized at a rural level, and as we bring them into the city, we need to upgrade their facilities so that we can accommodate city services to those areas and, you know, justify the annexation and provide the services that the city provides everyone else in the city. And there is a process for these things. Some of it is laid out in statute, but a lot of it, as was stated, is designed at the state, at the local level, either in our city charters or through a public ordinance process, which does have an immense amount of public input. If citizens want to become involved, they have local access to decisions that their city councils are making about how it is they'll proceed with going forward with local improvement districts or LIDs. So if there's a disagreement once an LID is formed, there are a number of ways that the LID can be challenged. There is first remonstrance at the local level, going directly to the city council and saying, I don't want my property to be part of this. And local rules say how much is the threshold before that puts the kibosh on the LID. I know we talked about oftentimes it's up to 60% of the landowners have to say no before the LID is turned down, or a percentage of the property owned. So that's the first step where residents can say no to the LID. The next is, of course, the courts, where they can come in and say the way they form this LID is just unsound, it's unfair, it's incorrect, and the court can look at it, take in what the local government heard, their record, and say, you know what, you're right, it's not fair. And the second time they can do that is when they're given the bill. And basically they can say, this bill is completely garbage. The way they proportion this out is not fair. And they need to relook at their way of distributing the costs. And the court can say, based on the record, it's fair or it's not. They can't say, okay, we're going to split the baby and give you, you know, this amount. Is that what you have to pay? They can say, local government, go back and do it again. So there are measures in place to control the system that is set up at a local level with local process. So we are very hesitant to interfere with that because we do believe that there is opportunity for residents to be involved in the process, to have their opinions heard. And with the proposed, when we talked yesterday, Mr. Hennick had mentioned the cap based on percentage of real market value, and the instant flag for me went up on those areas that are completely undeveloped. Their real market value might not be that large, but once those local improvements are put in place, suddenly you have a suburb, and your real market value is now equivalent or beyond the scope of what those local improvements are, and that needs to be put into consideration. I don't think any city wants to foreclose on local owners because they get a piece of property and that's what they get. And that's not something that's going to help them pay off the bonding that they had to take out in order to do the local improvements. Because local improvement districts aren't just a pot of cash that we can reach into. Usually they are a way to leverage bonding for recovery-based bonds that are slightly easier to get than general obligation bonds. But we have to have some source of income to pay for those bonds. And when we foreclose on a property, we've lost that potential income of those bankrupted payments. So foreclosure is not an option that cities want.
Well, hold on just for a minute there. Couldn't they rent the property out or sell it and get money?
Chair Clem, the issue is when we go and become landlords and use property for commercial purposes, we then also have property taxes and all the other taxes and stuff that goes on with that. It's very rare that the city wants to just have a chunk of property that, or especially undeveloped property, that maybe had improvements laid out to it, but then if the developer goes under, we just have this empty piece of property, then we have to build a building and then rent the building and then become subject to all the taxes. So
it depends upon the
circumstances. Yeah. But,
your point is, it's not their ideal first choice. There may be ways to recoup some dollars after selling it or whatever, but that's not a preferred route.
Chair Clem, yes, it's not preferred to foreclose.
And the court system that you describe, of course, is at that person's expense. There's no public defender given to people for this kind of work, is there?
Chair Clem, you're correct. There's no, everybody pays their way through the court system.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
No, I think that gets to some important points. But so I think there has to be a lot of consideration because the other half of the equation is the fact that we do need to extend infrastructure and we do need to find ways to pay for it. And cities have really limited options. We have taxes, which are capped. We have LADs. We have system development charges, which are only
limited
when the system capacity is being upgraded, not when local properties are being improved. and we have bonds or urban renewal districts, which are highly controversial and have requirements that you have to meet before you can even enter into an urban renewal district. So there's not a lot of options for how we finance funding, so or how we finance infrastructure. So we want to be careful about any sideboards or limitations we put on one of the more flexible methods that we have available to us. I'm happy to answer any questions.
I think that, you know, the main thing that we're going to have to come to terms with is there's the, like, 95% of the time, you know, people get infrastructure. Then there's, like, you know, a few cases where everything you describe sounds pretty good if they get the infrastructure. Then they you know, they have something of greater value, blah, blah, blah. This particular case, at least it's my understanding, if we drive out there, it's nothing. No streets, no sidewalks, no nothing, and a $6 million bill. And so that's where we want some tie to the benefit. Like, you have to get the benefit. You can't get your money if you don't provide at least some percentage of the benefits. I mean, something has to be there. Or we've got to say, go to court and explain how you didn't get the benefits, because the way Mr. Crean described it, you could go to court and say, but you got to have money. And you're being threatened with foreclosure if you don't just agree, or maybe a settlement. Hey, we'll give you some, you know, we'll give you some, we'll lowball you, or you can roll your dice trying to find the money to get a lawyer. So either we're going to start making the public defender handle these cases, the AG, the city's going to pay for it, or we're going to figure out some way that they at least get benefits if they're going to be assessed those kind of dollars. They got to get something for it. You know, and not just something meaningless either. I mean, it's got to be enough that they could actually then develop it or sell it, if that was the whole theory, I think. If they're going to be rolled in on a non-majority basis, whether they like it or not. If it were an opt-in deal, totally different story. But if they're going to have the ability to get voted in by the larger group, there's got to be some guarantee they're going to get something for their money, I think, anyway. And again, I know we do not want to kill the method that cities use to provide infrastructure. It's just how to stop the, you know, limited, maybe one or two or three, you know, a decade aberrations, I think, is what I'm interested in anyway. So, Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, excuse me, a couple questions. How is it determined whether an area is going to be assessed based on, well, or rejected based on population of an area or land area?
Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, normally what will happen is the city is either approached by a group of property owners or the council on its own has the authority to form an LID. There'll be a discussion of the formation of an LID. The council will adopt a resolution that sends the city engineer, or maybe an engineering firm that they hire, to go out and determine the boundaries of the LID, to determine the scope of the project and the total project costs. And at that point, once that determination is made and the total project costs are calculated, at that point, you go. The city will come up with a means of spreading those assessments, and these are all done internally. These are all city decisions. Then, the way it's supposed to work, at that point, and most city charters or city ordinances have provisions that give the property owners the ability to vote on whether or not to agree to form the LID. The vote is taken, and it's taken either on a property owner basis or on a percent on the total amount of land that's owned.
And that was my question. Who makes the determination on whether it is based on population?
That would be done at the local level.
Okay, then follow up.
So
there could be a situation where you have two landowners, one owns 99 acres and one owns 1 acre, and you know, you wouldn't get 60% based on population just because it's a 50-50 deal. So that, I don't know, that seems like one sideboard that would be potential. I mean, if there isn't a realistic expectation, you know, you have such a small population of people, of landowners, what do you want to say, it seems like you would never get to that threshold that you talked about with number of voters, number of property owners.
Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, there, because there's flexibility in the statutes now, and these decisions are predominantly left to the cities, there are opportunities for lack of a better term, mischief. There was a case, well, it was probably 15 years ago out of the city of Albany, where an LID was formed, a developer. It was in many ways similar to Kaiser. A developer purchased a large chunk of property for commercial, but big box development. There was infrastructure, street improvements needed to service this development. So the property owner convinced the city council, who was, you know, anxious to get the development, to agree to form an LID, where, and the boundaries of the LID were set so that he had 51% of the property within the LID. He owned and controlled 51% of the property. Therefore, the LID was formed. The other 49% of the property owners got to vote, but what's the purpose, what's the point of having the vote? So the LID was formed, and it's that kind of mischief that in some cases makes the vote really meaningless.
Mr. Chair, I have another question.
Please,
sort of separate from this. Who makes the determination as to whether an assessment is appropriate? I mean, it seems like if it is not the city's goal to own property, it seems like the city would make an assessment that's realistic. Otherwise, it is kind of set up for a default foreclosure. I'm just wondering, who is there anybody who above the city or anybody outside looking at it saying this doesn't seem like a really balanced assessment or anything like that?
Tara Clem, Representative Thatcher, there is the option of going to court, and the courts can look at it and say, based on the record, this assessment system seems wrong.
Oh, okay, so the property owner who doesn't have a representative, okay, they have to bring the case to court.
Yes. Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, we had a case a few years ago out of the city of Tigard where the city spread the assessments. Everybody voted based on what they thought their share of the total project costs were going to be. The project took over a decade to complete. At the end of the completion, the city came in and redid their method of assessment. The total project costs had more than doubled, and our client's share of the spread of the assessments went from 25% of total project costs to 50% of total project costs, while Costco's and Winco's went down considerably, sort of similar to what happened in Kaiser. And we challenged that, and we went to Washington County Circuit Court and to the Oregon Court of Appeals, and if I was charging by the hour, it would have been an exceedingly expensive process.
But I think also, like, that's not the norm. That's not the way that LIDs traditionally work in most cities. And, you know, I don't want the impression to be that every city's gone out there and done something like this. Like, there are the instances, and they do get reviewed, and they do get attention because I think that's something that the local government takes into account, where if they see one property owner is going to get, you know, like, an assessment that's, you know, way out of proportion, they're not going to want to do that to a property owner within the city limits. Like, that's not good governance, and that's what our council strive for, is good governance.
All right. Madam Chair, I guess I have a question as to how, so somebody says, okay, now you owe us $10 million, whatever, we're going to assess your property at millions of dollars, and you're like, what? I mean, is this for real? And now you have to dig into your own pocket, and I'm wondering how much something like that typically costs to bring it to court to appeal this decision. How, you know, what does something like that cost?
Vice Chair McEwen, mm-hmm. Representative Thatcher, the process would be to file what's known as a petition for writ of review, and you would file that in the circuit court of the county in which the property is located. that, depending on whether or not there's going to be a fight, which there likely will usually entail the preparation of a complaint, some discovery, maybe the hiring of an expert, and at least a day-long trial in circuit court, maybe a couple of days, maybe a could be a week, depending on how complicated the assessment is. And so, you know, I think at the trial court level, you're looking, just to get through the trial court, you're looking easily at $20,000 fee. And then, of course, there's always the opportunity, depending on whether which side prevails, to enjoy oral argument at the Oregon Court of Appeals and potentially a review at the Oregon Supreme Court. And that's in all likelihood, if that happens, that could potentially double the cost. So $40,000 or $50,000 bill, I don't think would be unreasonable, depending on how complicated it may be. That you can resolve it quickly and easily and spend, you know, $1,000, but it could be exceedingly expensive.
I have a part, and pardon my, I've been here about half an hour now, so my background is not very robust. Do counties, do LIDs come in county purview also, or is it just cities? Is this just a city issue?
Vice Chair McCune, I believe, well, that the LID ordinances are in Chapter 223 of the statutes, and I don't believe that they're limited to cities. I don't believe, because, you know, so many counties, especially in the Tri-County area, Washington County and Clackamas County and Multnomah County, have large areas of unincorporated urban, mm-hmm. inside the urban growth boundary properties. So I believe that counties are free to form LID ordinances as well, though I've never, I can't recall ever seeing one.
Vice Chair McCune, I have the statute here because
I
need to refresh myself on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. It says local government, so it's potential.
So
for
it
county,
could, but, you,
county
but you're not court. Seeing this emerge as a broader problem than just regarding this couple of city issues that have come up in the last.
Yeah, I believe
recent past.
One of the reasons why is that counties don't necessarily have to upgrade to city standards. They'll put in the infrastructure using other methods of payment. I'm not sure what counties use for their payments to make infrastructure additions, but
not typical.
This is not typical.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Just one real quick. So I don't know that maybe this was stated, but what in the Kaiser case, what was the amount of the assessment that they're foreclosing on? It was the dollar amount. If it was 20 times more, you know, give me sort of a
idea. Representative Holby, total amount of the assessments is, I think, at this point, $6.7 million. The property has gone up in value from the time, at the time of the original assessment, it was $300,000. The real market value was $300,000. I believe it's gone up to around the real market value is about $2 million. But it's still, you know, multiple times more than the value of the property. And for the Rollins family, it didn't really matter because, as they told the city at the time that the city was imposing the assessment on their property, we don't have $6 million. You know, our family doesn't have that. So there's no way we can repay it. But the Kaiser Station project was almost ready to develop. And so
thanks. Puts it in perspective for me. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, you got to remember, Kaiser basically, I think, was under the impression somebody else was going to pay for them. And that's maybe another discussion about the sideboards. And that's where it gets dangerous, speculating on speculation. I mean, speculating on the development, whether it's going to work or not, and then speculating on them to cover the other person so you don't have to feel quite so, you know, bad about the fact that they're getting stuck with it. It's like, well, he'll pay. Well, he's bankrupt. He already shafted the city for $800,000 on his own for them. So it's, you know, he can't necessarily pay for the other folks. And you know, it's like transferring the the liability several days down to make, given a reason why this is okay, it's not ideal, obviously. Because if the developer doesn't pay, then they're on the hook. And, you know, I think they felt like that was their only real choice, was make a deal with him, because they weren't going to get relief on the amount assessed. And particularly when the amount assessed, I think, it either jumped up or it got assessed not long after there was about a $6 million liability or a $6 million hole in their budget. All of a sudden, there's a $6 million assessment.
Yeah, these folks, their property was not originally in the LID, but there was a shortfall. And the similarly sized, the two big box stores out there with similar acreage, actually had a little bit more acreage, each paid $1 million. Their assessment was $1 million, and the city had a shortfall, so they needed more money to complete the infrastructure, and they were about $6 million short. That was about the same time that these folks' property was added to the district and assessed with a $6 million assessment.
Unfortunate coincidence.
So, okay.
Sorry, I was thinking that to myself. I said that out loud. Any more questions on this one? Okay. So we don't have to call it a work group, but we should talk. So that's how we can call it. We'll have a little talk. We'll have coffee and talk.
That's fair.
All right.
Committee talk.
Yeah, committee talk.
Good.
Get somebody to imitate the Saturday Night Live ladies. This would be good. Why not? Okay. I'll be in Asia. You guys have fun. Okay. So let's move on. I don't have to do that. And to the economic profile of rural Oregon. And ask our, this is Mark McMullen, our state economist. Okay. It's pretty exciting.
Oh, I hope so. Thanks for having me. For the record, Mark McMullen. I'm the state economist with the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis. I'll try to make my points brief and quick, but I do have three that I'd like to make today about rural economies. One is that we're all familiar with the challenges a lot of our rural communities face. I just want to point out that while things are challenging, they're not hopeless, and that we do have some opportunities in these areas, and that many of them certainly can turn around. But the second point is that there is an urgency to this, that it's really now or never before a lot of the damage done to the infrastructure and the workforces in these areas become irreversible.
Thank
and
you.
Some of these places will wither and die if business people and policymakers don't act to invest. And finally, the last point I'd like to make is that really this is as much of a problem for Portland and the Valley as it is for the rural communities, and that's often overlooked in the discussion. We talk about whether or not to invest or divest in these areas. Often, when urban centers would, I think folks from there sometimes discount the value that the rural communities have. This is not a parasitic relationship, but very much a symbiotic one, where our large metropolitan areas in the valley gain as much from the rural areas gain quite a bit from the rural areas and take as much from them as the rural areas take from the large cities. So to begin, just a quick update on where we are throughout this business cycle. This is employment, and we start in February 2008, when Oregon was at its peak employment before the recession hit. The recession hit all areas of the state hard, typical area losing 8 to 10% of its jobs during the downturn. But you'll see here since then, we've really diverged in terms of growth during the recovery, where Portland has seen slow and steady gains, where now they're less than 2% away from where they were before the recession hit in terms of the raw job counts, whereas with rural Oregon and the smaller metropolitan areas, we really haven't seen much improvement until only recently. But recently we actually have. We're starting to see an upturn in most areas of the state now, and particularly encouraging is in the in the areas that were hit hardest by the housing downturn. Some of these places, Central Oregon and Southern Oregon, although they're still far from recovered, they're finally starting to see some improvement, and a lot of that can be tied to housing activity, construction activity, and in addition to fewer job cuts at the state and local government level. So while the numbers are really bad, you know, for rural Oregon, when we look at educational attainment, poverty rates, all sorts of indicators, it's hard to find a lot of encouragement when we dig through these. But that being the case, the numbers aren't really awful. Awful was what these numbers were in 1980 for rural economies, when they were still dependent. A quarter of their economic activity was based on natural resource industries, which were on really shaky footing at the time. And we've seen all this attrition over 20 years or 30 years of cuts in this natural resource anchor of these economies. And so what this has led to is, of course, really bad looking numbers across the board because of all this attrition that these areas have faced. But to a large extent, a lot of these numbers are backward looking. They're not forward looking. They're not talking about what possibilities are there, but rather they really reflect again just the trauma that the areas' economies had to go through, the regional economies had to go through. So, this in of itself is an encouraging thing, that we've changed the tenor of the discussion. It's no longer where is the axe going to fall next. That said, we will see more mills close, but not to the extent that we have in the past. But now we're talking about, well, all these rural areas don't really have a lot of drivers or really opportunities or growth drivers. But that's a different conversation, and I think a more positive one. Insofar as we as economists can typically point out imbalances or things that are broken, but we aren't the ones to tell you, where the opportunities are going to come from and looking forward. And we typically don't predict these things. These are obviously the realm of developers and entrepreneurs and those who go out there and create the economic activity. But in general, there's no reason why we can't see growth going forward. And I think a lot of times when people are pessimistic based on the data and the raw numbers from 30,000 feet, it obscures the fact that going forward there aren't as many barriers as we might think. But the biggest barrier we do have here is in terms of the aging population and the workforce. I apologize for this chart, there's an error on it. The red lines are 2010 census, not 2000 census, but here we're looking at births to deaths. So if you're over 100%, that black line means more people are getting born in your county than are dying in your county in a given year. So we're having a natural increase in population. In 1980, all of our counties, save Wheeler, were growing naturally without any migration from the outside. That's changed drastically, over time, to where now most of our rural communities are losing more people than they're gaining. And so in order to grow, these places now have to depend on migration from the outside, where we're losing this cohort of younger individuals. You see here some areas it's not so bad across the state. You'll see Washington County, Morrow County, Marion County, Multnomah, Hood River. Some of these we haven't seen this natural rate decline to the same extent. There are two things going on here. One would be, of course, the places where we have more growth in the urban centers, where we're attracting more young households, are doing well, but also areas where we have more ethnic diversity, in particular Hispanic households. Some of the counties with a lot of Hispanic households are having more births and are maintaining their young workforce to a much better rate than others. You can see the difference even within the Tri-County area and in the Portland metropolitan area, Washington and Multnomah County, we haven't seen this aging, where Clackamas, this looks like a mix between the rural economies, as you might expect, between the rural economies where we and the urban ones, where we have less diversity and therefore a more rapidly aging population. So what does this mean? Well, in general, most of these areas are still at least maintaining their population, because a lot of them are still gaining migrants from abroad, I mean from other states, but that is very much sensitive to whether or not we have job opportunities. And so in terms of the workforce, we have a real urgency, a now or never time to invest in the workforce of a lot of our rural communities, because we're about to run out of these young workers. Here we're looking at population by age. The yellow band is the peak population for our regional economic development. What's super powerful for regional economic development is having these young households in their root setting years. When they're buying their houses, they're setting up their careers, they're buying cars and sofas and cribs and whatnot. And these are the most potent migrants in terms of helping in areas, relative economy, income, and the like. Well, you see here, of course, Portland has quite a few of them relative to the young folks, because they pull those households in from other areas, whereas in rural Oregon, that it tends to drop off. But for now, the children of the baby boomers are still there. You see, there's still a very large cohort of these folks in their late 20s that are still in rural Oregon right now. So to the extent that we're able to keep them there, and how do you do that? By matching them to job opportunities, to giving these young workers the skills that local employers need, and of course investing in those local employers themselves, can turn this around, but time is running out. We have a couple more years until these low birth rates start to kick in, and no longer will we have this native population with which we can train and match to employers. So at that point, when you lose the skilled workforce, it becomes a harder and harder sell to get firms to come to your area. And without the firms, of course, then you can't keep the workers. And so we'll get into this negative spiral. The same negative spiral exists on the infrastructure side of investment for a lot of rural areas. The idea being, as we lose infrastructure, it gets harder to attract the employers in rural areas. Often a huge challenge is their isolation, their geographic isolation. So to the extent that we can get people and goods to them, it is really a panacea, or certainly helps for economic activity. But these infrastructure investments become a harder and harder sell when they become more and more aspirational. When we talk about dredging this or paving that, and then we have this huge return on investment and get all these jobs, those are hard to sell to business investors and to policymakers when they're up against projects that have current capacity constraints and current needs. And so as our infrastructure ages in these rural areas, it will be a tougher and tougher sell in order to replenish it. And finally, the last point was that it's not just a rural problem, it's really a metropolitan area problem in Oregon as well. Why? Because of the flip side of the loss of these skilled workers from the rural side. We've really replaced over time. We used to have this flow down the tributaries of the Willamette and up into Portland area and through the valley cities of all the natural resource and the natural resource money that came from that, and the related industries and economic activity really kind of fed up the tributaries and into the bigger cities. Well, that was replaced over time by a flow of, instead of the natural resources, but human resources. And as much as these rural areas have, you know, lost in terms of sending away their skilled workers, these are urban areas have gained. And I often say that, you know, Portland's primary competitive advantage over other cities is the fact that it always has an ample supply of skilled workers, whether we train them locally or not. For Portland, they've been able to attract skilled workers from other states, ones that have, you know, when that investment in their education has been taking place elsewhere. So we've been largely a free rider on that. And the same is true for the Valley. Here we see the flow of workers, and the red line being excluding Portland and the blue line being including Portland in terms of flow across the state within Oregon. And so You know, so we see that Portland gains pretty much from everywhere. The Willamette Valley, Salem and Eugene take in folks from all these rural areas, but on net they lose population because of the flows up into the Portland metropolitan area. But basically all other areas are givers. They give into the valley in terms of their workforce, other than Northeast Oregon, which is a little bit of a specialized case right now because of the time period we're looking at here includes the big federal project up in Umatilla and all the wind projects that went up out there. So longer term, it'll look more like the others. But insofar as well, this is Portland's comparative advantage. And as we saw in the previous slide, you only got a couple years before this supply runs out. This tap runs dry if we don't continue to invest in our rural areas. And rural areas are a great place to raise workers and to train them. We've seen some work coming out of Berkeley very recently on upward mobility in America, and it looks at data across Oregon and the rest of the country, and it's clearly the case that these rural communities are still a great place to raise a family and to train workers going forward. A kid born poor in rural Oregon has about a 1 in 7 chance of being in the highest income 20% or quintile of income by the time they're 30 or 40. And if that same child were raised in the Portland region, that's only a 1 in 11 chance of moving up to the top of the income distribution. And this has been, I think is sometimes the value that the rural communities have been given in terms of this pipeline of skilled workers is sometimes discounted in the debate. So those are all the three points I want to make in my prepared remarks. You'll see in the slide deck, I've also included some slides about the structure of the different rural economies and what sort of jobs are available from high to low wage, but for anyone's interest. Thank you.
Okay, questions, comments, remarks? Representative Fetcher.
Just want a clarification on some people when they speak of infrastructure have in mind something, whereas somebody else might have something else in mind. What do you have in mind when you are speaking of infrastructure?
Oh, thank you, Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher. It's a broad range of things. We're about to hear about telecommunications. That counts, of course. Bridges and roads and the traditional things count as well, and public buildings and public programs also can count as infrastructure. But typically, what we're thinking about are some sort of physical investment, rather than what I'm excluding is human capital and the investment in education and whatnot.
No, follow up.
Yeah, follow up.
Okay, so then what you're talking about is something beyond maintaining current infrastructure. You're talking about increasing the supply, I guess, of physical investment, or, capital, whatever, around the state, especially in the rural areas. Is that right?
Yes, Representative Thatcher. In a lot of cases, it is increasing the existing stock of infrastructure, but in other cases, it's improving it. Coos Bay Railroad, for example, would be something that exists now, but they're talking about upgrading. Dredging ports would be another example of things that exist now that would be just repairing or bringing back up to operational capacity.
So in that conversation, you did mention programs. So are schools part of that infrastructure?
Representative Holby, absolutely, absolutely. We see, when I talk about, sometimes we also have to invest in setting up systems and programs. For example, the big cities or big counties in Oregon have a lot of community corrections in terms of they have probation programs and drug treatment programs that maybe some of the rural areas don't. So that would count as infrastructure insofar as, here comes a troubled kid, how are we going to take, or a troubled person, how are we going to take care of them? Well, some of the urban areas have more options because they have more developed public programs, so that would also count as infrastructure to a certain extent.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have to say, though, I find it interesting that though there are fewer of these programs in the rural areas, that the kids that are supposedly poor here in the rural areas have a higher chance of making it in life than the people where these programs are more readily available. I'm just saying.
Maybe they're not all poor.
Okay. Well, I'll just say one of the things that's been interesting for me, I grew up in Coos Bay, and you know, I have family members who left. One works for Microsoft in Bellevue. I obviously do live here in Salem. And my other brother, he went to the military. Then he went to Oregon State. Then he went to work for a tech firm in Beaverton. Then a global firm bought them, and they let him go back there as long as he had broadband. He can work there. So he does global IT support for a guy from Belgium, I think they are, for plastics injection molding companies all around the world from his garage. And, you know, he makes good money. And then he just flies around. So, like, last week he was in Hungary or Puerto Rico. One was Hungary. Next week was Puerto Rico. And he just goes to the North Bend Airport, flies, you know, occasionally has to go somewhere. So he goes to North Bend Airport, flies to, Eugene or Portland, and then goes on. Then he goes back and lives in our hometown with his wife and kids and sees grandma and grandpa all the time. And, you know, so I've always been, you know, convinced there's a way to make it work, you know, for people who aren't interested necessarily in something related to the natural resource industries. I want to see those healthy again personally. But for other people, that's just not what they're interested in, or that's not their thing. There still needs to be a way for them to go back and make a decent living. You know, there's certainly times where I thought about it. I was just not sure what I would do for a living exactly with my limited skill set. So, it's a personal thing for me to figure out how to, you know, make places like my hometown healthy again. It's very hard for me to even go there and not get upset, to be honest. So I spent a lot of time thinking about that. But I also realize that, you know, urbanization is something that happens around the world. It's not just us who has people moving to the city, you know, to find work. It's just something I'd like to figure out a unique solution so people have those opportunities on an ongoing basis. And as you said, we don't kind of lose this moment where it's getting close to being a little late to reverse trends if we don't do something.
That's right, Representative Clement. What you mentioned is great. In terms of infrastructure, of course, I think you've mentioned the North Bend Airport.
Yep.
That's terrific. But your brother's a great example, because when I talk about this symbiotic relationship, what do the rural areas get? Well, a lot of our rural economists in the state, particularly OSU, would argue that the way to succeed is to tie yourself to the urban economies the other way around.
Definitely.
To have these links, like your brother would be a great example, to do all we can to try to, and the economies that are able to immerse themselves or join themselves to the valley economies are those that are going to succeed the most.
And I think it's better for us all too to know each other more. You know, I mean, I was a little scared of Portland, and when I live in Coos Bay, I did not really want to go to Portland. The only things that made the news down there were gang shootings, nothing else. That's really all I knew about Portland. And it was in the 80s, and they'd make the news down there. So I was a little scared about the whole thing. Now I love Portland. It's enjoyable. I like to go and visit there and, you know, hang out. But there was no way anyone was going to talk me into going there. And I just had an image of it that was different. And I noticed things when we, like, do the farm-to-school program, is those kids get to go out and see the farms where their food's coming from now. And the farmers know, hey, I'm making a lot of money off of that Portland Public School District. People seem to get to know each other better. And I think it's got that benefit beyond the economics.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm supposed to get on a plane soon, so let's move on. Thank you. And get Chris up.
Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christopher Tamron. I'm with the Oregon Business Development Department. I want to thank you for allowing me to be here this morning to provide a 10-minute briefing on broadband in Oregon, its availability, infrastructure funding sources, and current issues. There's a lot going on in the world of broadband, internet protocol networks, and related information technologies. So if I may, I'm going to give you an executive summary, and then we can drill down for more detailed information on any specific topics or issues. Regarding broadband service availability in Oregon, a useful reference tool is the Oregon Broadband Map, which you see in front of you. The interactive map, which is located at broadband.oregon.gov, presents broadband service data, and it's searchable by geographic area. You can search by street address, by municipality, by county, by tribal lands, or by positioning a pushpin icon at the desired location on the map. Searchable data is also available on service transmission speeds, service technologies, and service providers, including hot links to service provider websites. Also included on the map are community institutions, including the schools, libraries, hospitals, colleges, and universities, medical healthcare facilities, and public safety entities, all identified and searchable by name and location, though you need to zoom in on the map for them to appear. So how is Oregon doing? Both in broadband availability and adoption, Oregon ranks highly for a big western state with a relatively small population. NTIA, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, reports that over 74% of all Oregon households have broadband in the home and ranks Oregon as sixth in the nation, behind Utah, New Hampshire, Washington State, Massachusetts and Connecticut in rates of adoption. And, of course, Oregon ranks ahead of the nation as a whole. The FCC reports that 2% of Oregon's population is unserved compared to the national average of 8%. But despite Oregon's positive statewide standing relative to other states and the country as a whole, challenges remain. In another study, NTIA reports that digital divide differences continue to exist between urban and rural areas of Oregon as well as the rest of the country. For example, while nearly 100% of urban residents have access to broadband services with download speeds of at least 6 megabits per second, 82% of rural communities have that access. And where nearly 88% of urban residents have access to broadband speeds of 25 megabits per second, only 41% of rural residents have that same access. Here again, though, Oregon also outperforms the nationwide statistics in the report. Oregon is ranked ninth in the nation for percentage of population that has broadband service available at greater or equal to 25 megabits per second, and Oregon is ranked ninth in the nation for percentage of population that has broadband service available at speeds of greater than 50 megabits per second. And Oregon also ranks highly in access to broadband in its rural communities relative to the rest of the country. Though we should note that rural rates of adoption are lower than urban rates. So, for example, the adoption rate in Portland is 87% versus 66% in eastern Oregon. And I think what we see here is that broadband service quality continues to be a moving target, with services and transmissions speeds steadily improving over time, making the challenge always a work in progress.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Holley.
Can you explain to me what adoption, in your reference to adoption?
You subscribe to broadband service.
The adoption rate is people that choose to do it?
Yeah. Okay. So you've got service availability. The service is available if you want it. Adoption means that you subscribe to it and use it.
Okay.
Funding for broadband in Oregon comes from both public and private sources. The primary public sources of funding in the form of loans and grants, and it's by far loan programs, include FCC programs, notably the Universal Service Fund and its High Cost to Serve program, the Schools and Libraries E-Rate program, the Rural Health Care Program, and Lifeline Program. Oregon providers received approximately $103 million in the fiscal year 2011 from Universal Service Fund programs. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Utilities Service Programs are significant, notably the Community Connect and Telecommunications Infrastructure Loan Program. Over the fiscal years 2009 through 2012, Oregon projects received over $67 million in funding from USDA programs. Programs funded by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, 14 based Oregon-based projects received over $52 million in federal funding for infrastructure projects, as well as a computer and education center in Crook County, and for statewide broadband mapping. Though I should note that about $21 million of the USDA funding that I cited came from ARRA-funded programs. Telecommunications infrastructure projects also qualify for funding from the Oregon Special Public Works Fund, and funding comes from directly from municipalities, counties, ports, and tribes. Some of these public entities have provided funding for broadband network projects. Examples would include Ashland FiberNet, MyNet, the Fiber to the Home project in Monmouth and Independence, the QLife Network, fiber network project in the Dalles, and Warm Springs Telecom. But by far, the greatest source of funds has been from the private sector and private sector investment by service providers. In recent years, Oregon's cable companies have invested in the neighborhood of $140 million annually in upgrades of their facilities. Frontier Communications invested over $37 million upgrading the network that it acquired from Verizon. CenturyLink has invested more than $45 million to upgrade and expand its broadband network. After having taken over from Qwest. In the first half of 2013, AT&T invested nearly $80 million in its wireless and wireline networks in Oregon, and this is in addition to nearly $325 million that AT&T has invested in its Oregon wireless and wireline networks from 2010 through 2012, reflecting the explosive growth in mobile wireless service. The Oregon Broadband Advisory Council was created in 2009 by the legislature.
The numbers you just gave, that's like the big numbers. That's across the state, urban and rural areas.
Yes.
Yeah. Do we have any sense of what chunks rural versus my house down here, you know, which...
I don't have a breakdown by urban and rural areas, although it's safe to assume that there's more investment because there's more physical infrastructure in the urban areas than in the rural areas. However, there have been significant strides and improvement in services in the rural areas over the past 10 years. With the improvement of backbone network infrastructure, which then has enabled the development of distribution networks that provide services to people in their homes and places of work, mm-hmm. both through wireline technologies like DSL from a telephone mm-hmm. company or cable modem service from a cable company or mobile wireless or fixed wireless services. And then also a significant improvement over the past 2 years has been improvement in the quality of satellite services.
I was going to mention that. I don't know if it was really an ARRA project or that was a marketing gimmick, but my dad lives out along the Umpqua River, you know, way out, no neighbors for anywhere, 13 miles from Sutherland. And HughesNet sent him something and said, you know, for ARRA, we can do a free installation, and you pay the monthly bill or something like that. And so now he's got Internet out there, and you know, I can Wi-Fi while I'm fishing almost.
ARRA did focus on satellite providers for the hardest-to-reach rural areas in the country. And as I said, significant technical improvements have been made in satellite-provided broadband services just in the last 2 years. So now it's possible to get 12 to 15 megabits per second download speeds from satellite providers pretty much anywhere where you have a view of the southern sky.
Yeah.
So if you're butted up against a mountain range or tall trees, you still might have an issue. But if again, you can see the southern sky, a significantly improved level of broadband service is now available from satellite providers.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Thatcher.
Before we go on, I loved the numbers that you were saying, and I wished I had been taking notes right when you were saying how much from what area things, you know, investments. I'm wondering if we could get that information.
Sure. Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, I'll provide that those numbers to you. As I was saying, the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council was created in the 2009 legislative session to help ensure the implementation of statewide broadband strategies. The mission of the council is to encourage coordination and collaboration to leverage broadband for education, workforce development, and telehealth in Oregon's communities. It reports on the status of broadband and broadband issues to the legislature and the governor. The council has identified and is currently addressing several key issues in the area of broadband. The first is in K through 12 schools. Broadband network access and supporting information technology systems are fast becoming essential infrastructure for Oregon's schools as course content materials, student assessment, school administration, and teacher training and professional development all are migrating to digital media and are all migrating to cloud-based applications. Current and detailed information on broadband network access and supporting IT infrastructure in Oregon's K through 12 schools is not available for needs assessment, policy development, and strategic planning. Anecdotal data indicates that there is currently a wide range of broadband access and supporting facilities in place in Oregon schools, and consequently a wide range of preparedness for the digital future, an important issue cited by the council. Second, healthcare. Oregon is recognized as a national leader in telemedicine and telehealth deployment, as well as in telemedicine public policy. Earlier this year, Senate Bills 569 and 604 were passed and signed into law. They will help streamline and make more manageable the processes for credentialing physicians in Oregon to be able to provide clinical services remotely at other hospitals through telemedicine. And in turn, this will promote the use of telemedicine as a strategy to deliver health care to people where they live for the benefit of individual patients, as well as for the economic health and viability of their communities. As Oregon proceeds to develop a new model for coordinated healthcare delivery, it's important to be able to integrate telehealth and telemedicine strategies in that new model. Public safety. In 2012, the federal government funded and began plans to deploy the National Public Safety Broadband Network. It's more widely known as FirstNet, short for First Responders Network. Oregon will be facing an opt-in, opt-out decision regarding participation and interconnection with this national network within the next 2 years. The initial level of funding was $7 billion for the project. There's also a potential for significant additional wireless broadband infrastructure investment as that network develops over the next 5 or 6 years.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Thatcher.
As you're talking about this FirstNet stuff, does this have anything to do with the project previously known as OWEN?
No. The OWEN was a narrowband network. It was essentially a push to talk trunk radio system, and of course, didn't happen. That the we now have the Oregon State Radio project, which is moving to a process of narrow banding, reducing the amount of bandwidth that public safety radio networks are using this in response to an FCC order. This FirstNet is a national initiative, and it is a broadband network. So it'll be able to support data and data applications such as image transfer, document transfer, video transfer, in addition to voice.
Sounds like it'd be better than the narrowband. But anyway, go ahead. Thanks.
And again, this is a significant national initiative. Oregon is directly engaged. The former chair of the state executive interoperability council from Oregon is one of 12 members of the FirstNet board of directors, which positions us well to influence that process and participate in it. Other issues, FCC Universal Service Fund and intercarrier compensation reforms. The FCC has been engaged in reforms of the Universal Service Form, Fund, rather, to redirect those funds more towards broadband development, as well as intercarrier compensation reforms, the system by which carriers pay to exchange traffic and terminate calls and transmissions. These changes are resulting in significant reductions in revenue for small rural incumbent carriers. And ironically, that might ultimately result in a reduction of service availability in rural areas, or even possibly a loss of some of those rural carriers that can no longer sustain their businesses. This is an area of concern and one that's being watched. And finally, broadband adoption and utilization. The Internet is emerging as the global platform for communications, for business, for government, for education, for information storage and distribution, and for entertainment. Telecommunications infrastructure is now critical to local communities of all sizes and all areas of the state, and it grows in importance with economic globalization. The Council believes that Oregon needs to be strategically planning for, promoting, and improving rates of broadband adoption and utilization at the local community level. I've included some follow-up information sources for reference, including the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council's report, and I'll do my best to answer any questions.
Representative Holvey.
Thank you. I appreciate this presentation. I know it's extremely critical to a lot of rural areas, and certainly I have a couple in my district that have struggled with getting access to broadband and keep making improvements. Is there some place where we can check the status of broadband implementation in areas? Specific areas in the state?
Is there Chair Clem and Representative Holvey.
Inventory of so?
Yes, and I mentioned the Oregon broadband map earlier, and that will give you a good current status of broadband availability in any area of the state. And again, as I mentioned, it's searchable by municipal area or county or down to the individual address, and we'll tell you the service providers that are available, as well as provide hot links to their websites.
And is there a link to that map in your documents?
Yeah, it's broadband.oregon.gov.
Thanks. Any other questions? Representative Thatcher.
You mentioned at the beginning of the presentation how we in Oregon are, I guess, broad adopters of broadband, and we rank up there with some other states. And I'm just wondering, those top 6-10 states, however you want to say, it would be interesting to see what the investment is from the private sector versus the public sector. Do you have that information, or is that readily available? I don't want you to have to go through big exercises to get it, but
as I mentioned, just in broad numbers, I would estimate that for all the states, with some levels of variation, by far the largest level of investment is from private sector service provider investment.
I did hear that, but I guess I was just wondering if the other states had more. I mean, or is it you're saying it is pretty even?
I don't have working knowledge of what the levels are in other states and to what degrees they might have public sector funded networks. But.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you.
With that, we'll adjourn our Interim Committee on Rural Communities, unless there's anything else for the good of the order.
All right.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
That's a good question.